Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you, Vice-Chancellor, for that very kind introduction. As the Vice-Chancellor hinted, I'm a rather peculiar character in modern academia, in the sense of someone who spent most of his career, and I have to say I'm now in my 40th year as a professional economist. I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. Maybe you'll be able to tell me by the end of this evening. And I don't think either the people who taught me at Glasgow or even I thought that at this stage in my career I would be an academic, and indeed with a full chair. It just shows that so much in life is indeed accident in these circumstances. And indeed, becoming an economist was almost by accident. Those of you who know me well will not be surprised to know that I was a rather indolent scholar as an undergraduate, and indeed as a schoolboy. As the Vice Chancellor said, I started off in agricultural economics. Well, agriculture, in fact, because I wanted to be a chemist, something for which I revealed absolutely no talent whatsoever as time went on. And at that time, I think there was a bit of a feeling of inferiority among the agricultural chemists. They felt they were thought of as bucket chemists, and I came to think of myself as a bit of a bucket economist in this context. I think I'm interested in policy. I'm interested in what economics can do to make policy better. I'm interested in what economics can do to advance the lot of people, ordinary people. I've been doing trade policy almost all of my professional life. I started out in the Ministry of Agriculture doing something quite different, but very quickly got engaged with the negotiations to join and then to adapt to the Common Agricultural Policy in the early 1970s. That's where I probably, in a sense, learned my trade. I then went off to LSE, where Alistair Smith actually taught me the rest of my trade. So it's all his fault if you want to blame anyone at this point. And all the way through, I mean, what I've been interested in has been, in effect, the impact of what I call regionalism tonight. There are lots of titles, lots of names for this, some of which will come through. But basically, it's liberalization, which is discriminatory. In other words, you don't discriminate, you don't liberalize across the board to everyone. You pick your partners to liberalize. What I want to talk about tonight is roughly in this outline. It's a question of what's going on and who's doing it. To put it in an empirical context, why does it matter? The effects of discrimination. Some thoughts on market-led integration, which owes much to our colleague Sherman Robinson, whose work I steal and without shame at this point. And then I'll go through some of the elements that are in the title, indeed, coming down to the challenge for policymakers and the challenge for economists, and point to some things. We're colleagues here. I think of myself as a part of a team. I've always felt comfortable in teams. The civil service keeps you in that sort of position. What I'm doing tonight is, I hope, reflects properly the work that I've been doing with colleagues here, most of whom are in the room and who will no doubt put me right if I've got it wrong. So what's going on? RTAs, regional trading arrangements, noted to the GATT, the WTO, which is the global regulator of trade in a shorthand way. And you can see going all the way back to 1948 when the GATT was first, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade was first instituted itself. We've seen, and the key date here is around 1992, 93 with the birth of the World Trade Organization, we see a sudden leap. And the line you're really interested in this to the extent you're interested, is the black one, because these are the ones that are actually in operation. And you can see there are around 200 of them. And you can see there's been a pretty stiff rise since 1993. The slight up and down is a peculiarity of what happens when countries join the European Union. This is that W shape, what makes an M shape, sorry. That M shape there is Poland and other countries joining the European Union. That counts as one new agreement. And then all their hundreds of agreements with other people disappear, and then so you get them knocked out. So you get a strange little shape there. But basically, there are 200 of them live at this moment, and there's quite a lot in the pipeline. Just a week or so ago, Japan signed a free trade area with ASEAN, which is a group of 19 countries in Southeast Asia. So you can see this is going on a pace, particularly in Asia at the moment. Who's doing it? Well, the thing I want to just concentrate on the final column here, which is the total. This is some derivations from the basic database. Basically, there are 125 out of the almost 200 that have been done either south-south, meaning developing country to developing country, or north-south, meaning developed to developing. Depending on how you think of the transition economies in places like Central Asia, whether you think they're developing countries or not, you could add them in. The point I want to make is that more than half of them involve developing countries. And that's an important reason for thinking about what their effects may be, because developing countries have rather special characteristics. Typically, when one thinks about regional trading arrangements, the EU is the first thing that comes to head, or perhaps the North American Free Trade Area. But these are among countries which are heavily developed. Economists have thought quite hard about discriminatory liberalization. What is it? It's the removing of trade barriers, completely or in part, for some but not all of your trade partners. And what are the effects? Well, what economists came up with, one in particular called Viner, but developed over a subsequent couple of decades, were two concepts which finally suggested and settled a debate about whether this partial liberalization was good or bad for country. By and large, people would say more liberalization must be a good thing. Free trade's good for you. That's the standard economist prescription. Therefore, more free trade, even if it's with a selection of partners, not all of them, is good. Well, what we now know is that's not quite true. Indeed, it's not true. It frankly has to be. It's an empirical question. Because two things happen when you reduce barriers against one group of countries but not another. The first one is you get trade creation, that is, you reduce the barriers against the, let's say, for shorthand, the most efficient producers. And that knocks out domestic producers who are less efficient. And your whole economy then moves around into a more efficient constellation of resource use. Now, it's interesting, economists think this is the big benefit from freeing up trade. If you're a politician, of course, the first thing you say is that causes unemployment. Another reason for thinking economists don't always think the same way as everyone else. But the key point is the economy then has to adjust. The unemployed are then absorbed net into other and more efficient uses. But the other effect is trade diversion. Trade diversion is when you displace an efficient foreign supplier on your market currently with an inefficient one, because the inefficient one has had the barriers removed, has got the benefit of a preference in the jargon. And it's the sum of these two effects that tell you what's good for the economy or whether it's bad for the economy. And most economists would then say, well, non-discriminatory trade liberalization, where you're just barriers against everyone, by and large ought to dominate discriminatory liberalization, because it's all trade creation under those circumstances. If you move the barriers against all of your partners, the most efficient one, in some sense, wins the competition and gets the chance to displace your domestic production. And that's the sort of key set of ideas that we've generally brought to this. There's one other issue I want to bring up, which is it's a pervasive metaphor now of the spaghetti bowl of trade agreements. I'm going to show a couple of diagrams which are simply there to say, God, this is complicated. Because what happens is that people don't just have one preferential arrangement. They may have multiples. As I say, and at one point in Europe, you could count the regional trading or the bilateral agreements in hundreds because everyone was making pairwise combinations with everyone else. So this is the overlap that you see just in the Western Hemisphere. And I won't talk you through it. The fact of it is just look at it and absorb that it's complicated. This is what's going on more or less currently in Asia, which is the home currently of the most rapidly regionalizing part of the world in this context. And this is a bit where I borrow from Sherman Robinson. He's in Mozambique, so he won't mind, I don't think, at the moment. And he did some very clever stuff with trade statistics, looking at clustering of trade relationships. I won't talk you through that at this point, except to say that it's, as I say, it's a purely programming and mathematical technique. It's not got a model. It's not got a behavioral model in it. So there's a question mark here whether these clusters, what's causing these clusters. But I think they're quite striking in themselves, because one of the things they tend to suggest is that the market's been leading this sort of regional integration rather than policy. The subtitle of this is, might be, particularly now, Welcome to the Global Pin Factory. If anyone's got a new £20 note in their pocket, they'll see on the back of that the icon of Adam Smith, and also a note of here and a little diagram supposedly representing his rather, for at least for economists anyway, famous example of the benefits of specialization in a pin factory. The one thing about Adam Smith was he wasn't afraid of examples. He was quite happy to give you examples when the generalizations were difficult to follow. And here we're looking at the 1960s, and I think what you see here are generally sort of quasi-colonial effects in North and Latin America, but these are areas where basically there's more intra-trade than extra-trade. The same we see here between Europe and former colonies. It's rather strange. Some of it's little, some oddities with the position of the UK here. Here we see the purple is basically ex-bits of the British Empire, which are trading among themselves still at that point. When we get into the 70s, that starts to clear. Interestingly, we begin to see the enlarged EU that includes Spain and Portugal, even Poland, Scandinavia, as well as the actual members, and starting to stretch out towards Morocco. We begin to see an Asian bloc forming. We see North America forming, and we see, and I have to say, there's not a lot of trade in this one, a beginning of a South American one. Then we get to the 1990s, and we see just this, the huge block here that prejudges the enlargements of the EU that took place in the early 2000s. We see Australia and others growing into the East Asian bloc, but we see that Africa and South Asia are sort of left out. We see the beginnings. This purple area here is Mercosur. This rather lilac-y area, I don't know, cyan, I think it's called in the list, is that all around South Africa and up into Central Africa. So you see blocks appearing, as I say, in the actual trade statistics, and it comes ahead of governments getting involved. And the other thing that we see happening is the fragmentation of the production chain. And this is the first hint of what we call deep integration. Here's what goes into a hard drive exported by Thailand. And you see it comes from all over the world, some within Thailand, within Southeast Asia, some from Japan, some from the US indeed, some from China. And almost certainly that hard drive went back to China to end up in something like a Lenovo computer or its equivalent now. Now, this sort of specialization has gone on in the past, but with modern technology and modern communications, we now have a lot more. Here's another example, which is just all the different, you know, from Japan through France, through the USA, through the UK, the wide range of really quite highly complex, and I think the key point here is specialized inputs that go into the finished vehicle that some of you may indeed own, a Volvo S40, coming from all around the world. And as I say, the key point about these is we're getting gains from specialization along the lines Adam Smith pointed out, which is not the more usual explanation for trade given by economists. I won't go into that tonight, and some people may raise it from the audience later, well and good. The thing is that modern technology and communications make it more intense. It doesn't all happen inside the pin factory. The pin factory is now the global economy in this context. It's not ship and forget. It's not just a standard tire that's going on. It's not just some standard gearbox. It's not just some standard fuel pump. These are specific. They're highly integrated into the product chain by firm-level standards. So Volvo is setting the standards here, and they're not the same as BMW standards or anything like this. Some of that is run by investment. So Volvo's invested in some firms in wherever, Thailand or China or whatever. Some of it's by the transfer of proprietary technology to pre-existing firms and so on. It's the key to the modern rise of China and India in trade in goods and services. Because we look around, in services you think of call centers, you think of India's software specializations where they're doing custom-built software basically down the line for users in developed countries at this point. So one of the questions that this raises is whether the policy of regional integration, because we've seen, we've now had basically 200 new agreements in the last 15 years. We have more in the pipeline. Is this following the market? Is it and embedding it rather than leading it? Because certainly in the past, we tended to think, we thought the EU led the story. And I think that may have been true in the early days, given post-war recovery and so on, which was still an issue at the end of the 50s and into the early 60s when the EU came along. But the other point about it is that we're engaged in this deep integration, which means that you're absolutely, it's not ship and forget, as I say, it's you're absolutely integrated into the production chains of the firms you're dealing with. And the question is if this, and we think, and I'll come on to this in a moment, think that this deep integration, the key to this deep integration is that it's very important in raising productivity. And if you're raising productivity, then you've got a good chance you're going to be contributing to growth. And that means that the gains from this sort of trade are much higher than the traditional gains that we talk about the trade creation that I was talking about earlier on, which tend to be from just simply reallocating resources to more efficient uses. So let me just say a little bit about shallow and deep integration, because I've been throwing the deep integration term around. Now, two elements. I mean, the shallow integration story is one that is fairly easy to understand. It's removing taxes, tariffs. We're all pretty well aware of tariffs. Or quotas, quantitative restrictions on imports. We spent a lot of the 1950s and 60s and 70s getting rid of things like quotas. We've moved everything towards tariffs, and economists think they understand tariffs quite well because basically they introduce a wedge between world prices and domestic prices. There are cost differences as far as the consumer is concerned. And we convert lots of other policy instruments into what we call tariff equivalents. Deep integration is a bit different, but because it's partly about reducing the obstacles to trade presented by domestic regulation. Domestic regulation is not usually there to reduce trade. It's there to deal with, in economist terms, some market failure. It might be, for example, regulation on environmental standards or something like that that's simply not picked up in the market. If you have regulation which is not similar to the rest of the world, then that sets up a barrier to people trying to sell you goods and services. So that by harmonizing on global norms or by harmonizing with trading partners by mutual recognition. Mutual recognition, I think, is, for example, mutual recognition of qualifications, something that we all recognize. If India starts recognizing European lawyers as able to practice in India and Europeans start recognizing Indian lawyers as qualified to practice in within the EU in an agreement between the EU and India, which is currently under negotiation, then that will increase trade in legal services between the two places without them actually having to follow the same degree courses. We simply have to accept that, broadly speaking, Indian lawyers are equivalent to British or French or other European lawyers. It's not self-evident. I mean, it took the EU, the EC and its various things, almost 30 years to come to the conclusion that they couldn't harmonize the rules on what constituted an architect, sometimes known as the second oldest profession. And we had to sort of give up on that around the mid-1980s and decide to go down the mutual recognition route in all of this. So what's the challenge for policymakers in this context? Well, the first problem for policymakers is that each preferential agreement, they're usually done bilaterally. I mean, the enlargement of the EU is unusual in this context. It's not often you get these sorts of natural growth, so to speak, in existing regional agreements. So accessions are not the norm. And if, for example, you're India, you're in the middle of negotiating something with the EU, the Japanese are on the sidelines wanting to negotiate with you, the Americans may be on the sidelines, you've just finished negotiating something with Singapore, you're talking about integrating with your neighboring countries in South Asia, and have been for some time. All of these agreements are different. This goes all the way back to the spaghetti bowl story. And that means that it requires a lot of detailed information and knowledge just to specify the agreements. And then you have to calculate the costs and benefits for each one. And that means the costs and benefits can vary with each one. Now, for the shallow integration story, this is conceptually fairly straightforward. Javi and others who do a lot of the heavy lift on calculating some of these things for some of the work we're currently doing may argue that it may not be rocket science, but it's quite difficult nonetheless to do, and that's true. So there's an information problem there. But actually, you know, we think we've got a handle on it. We've got some rules of thumb, I'll come on to this in a moment, that help us predict without a lot of heavyweight calculation what the impact of any particular agreement is likely to be on the shallow integration. But for deep integration, it's much more difficult. Changing regulations may change costs, and for a long time, we've looked at regulation as if economists tended to look at regulation as if it was simply something that increased costs. But it may also change the benefits from regulation. After all, people don't necessarily and don't usually put regulation in place because they think it has no benefits. They usually think it has some benefits. And they usually think those benefits outweigh the costs. In the sort of rationalist discourse that the economists are used to, that's a sort of self-evident point. So if you change your regulation, you may change the nature of the output. The output may be more valuable to you or may be less valuable to you. But it's pretty complicated and hard to tell, something I'll come on to again in a moment, because of the difficulties of defining exactly what it is in regulation that changes behavior. And this is all complicated, and I think this is particularly so for small and developing countries, by the fact that each agreement is unique. And I put alongside that the lack of analytical capacity. When I joined the British Civil Service in 1968, there were around 200 to 300 economists in Whitehall. Now we're talking something like 1,500 or 1,600 economists in Whitehall. Most developing countries don't have access to that amount of skill. Indeed, one definition of a developing country is it simply doesn't have what economists call the human capital required to push them up the development ladder. And that lack of capacity is there in administration as well as in markets and in the normal private sector. And one of the things that we have tried to do here at Sussex, and this is the bit, I think, which I claim, I think, a little bit of absolutely personal input here, is we've tried to design and implement an analytical and diagnostic framework which will help negotiators deal with any particular, any given proposal. If you're the EU, you're probably negotiating 10 or 15 agreements at the same time. All of these agreements have a very similar pattern. But if you're ECOWAS in West Africa, if you're India, this is a unique agreement for them that they're negotiating. They have no ability to learn by, or at least they have fewer opportunities to learn by doing. And in this context, we put together a framework that helps them short-circuit a lot of the problems that arise by allowing them basically in a standardized analytical approach to pull out a number of rules of thumb that will allow them to identify whether they're likely to run into problems of trade diversion, whether there's benefits from trade creation. And you can see it's pretty strong, because the economic analysis is pretty strong, on shallow integration. It's also pretty good on trade and goods, because we've got a lot of information on trade and goods. This raises a little bit of a problem. It's a little bit like the drunk man looking for his keys under the lamppost. When asked if that's where he lost them, he said, no, but this is where the light is. Because we've got lots of statistics on goods, we've got it to very fine degrees of disaggregation. We feel as if we are really getting to grips with things. But if you take an economy like the EU, which is probably 75 to 80% services, whose trade in services now is getting close to its trade, meaning exports and imports, of goods, then this doesn't necessarily tell you all of the story. And in a modern world in which manufacturing is moving east faster than we can blink, and we've been told that services is where the future of our developed economies is, not to have a handle on services is clearly to miss a big issue. And services is normally regulated. Services are normally regulated. Services trade doesn't face tariffs as such. It faces regulatory barriers. Alan Winters, who's in the audience, will tell you that if you want to send a worker to deliver a service in a foreign country, it's extremely hard. It's in the jargon is mode four. Alan's calculations suggest that if we could get liberalization of that, it would do more for the developing countries than almost any other bit of trade liberalization that we could do. So these sorts of regulatory barriers are quite core to or crucial to the issues which we want to talk about. But that gap is there in the analytical armory. We've used the Sussex framework to look at preferential integration in the Mediterranean, in the Caribbean, in West and East Africa, both with themselves, among themselves meaning, and also with the EU, and between the EU and Russia, and EU and Ukraine, and India and Korea. Now, we think this is pretty useful, the fact that we've been able to sell it to some people, which is a market test, which is what economists like to be able to do, tells us it's got some value for someone somewhere and not simply dealing with an intellectual puzzle from our perspective. We think it's useful But we certainly recognize it does have gaps, and I'll come on to that in a moment. Now, the strange little acronym at the bottom is to take this, the Sussex framework one step further. Because in context with, wider negotiations on the interactions between regional agreements and the World Trade Organization, which I won't touch on tonight, but is an important issue, I have proposed that there should be a new small international organization called the Advisory Center on Regional Trading Arrangements, which would actually provide advice and analysis to develop, mainly to develop, well, to developing countries who are engaged in regional in negotiations on regional or bilateral trade arrangements. And this is raising the Sussex framework to perhaps another level altogether. It's a very cheap little organization. I reckon it only costs about a couple of million a year to run, but I think it has got significant and substantial potential payoffs in terms of global welfare and in terms of insurance for developing countries that they're not signing up for things that they haven't, not because they're not able to in an intellectual sense, but they simply haven't got the resources, the people, the number of people required to make sure that they're not making mistakes in these complex negotiations. Challenges for economic analysis from deep integration, which is where the main problem arises. How do we think this deep integration works? And there are some plausible suggestions around. These come out of a lot discussions among a group of economists here at Sussex, including Mike Gajarek and Peter Holmes and Alistair Smith and various others. It looks like it's the sorts of issues that I've listed here. Technology spillovers, meaning that by getting yourself into a supply chain, you start absorbing new technologies and you move up the technology ladder, and those technologies then spill over to other firms and producers in your economy as you raise your demands on them. It's increased foreign direct investment, this is FDI, and that points again to questions of investment rules, government procurement, competition policy, intellectual property rights. Improved access to markets, because this through improved standards regimes, which means to know whether your goods meet the standards of your target markets requires a really complex testing and certification procedures, which a lot of developing countries haven't got the capacity to produce. Again, the shortage of people involved in that. But if you can improve your standards, that can then lead to productivity increases because you start being able to produce more varieties, better quality varieties of the products. You can focus them on particular markets. You can move up market and so on. So you start then raising the revenues that you can get from this. Getting rid of rent-seeking. I mean, government procurement, well-known around the world for being a way of financing political parties. That's what we mean by rent-seeking in this context. Government contracts go to the highest bidder rather than the lowest cost provider. We get these sorts of Smithian specialization gains, so you get local economies of scale by specialization in different parts of the value chain. And this comes out from, again, possibly from common standards and perhaps from preferential market access. That's one of the puzzles. And then we get the sort of externalities you get from improving standard setting, as I've said, the legal system, which may improve because you're engaged with the EU. Well, what was the main problem about Bulgaria and Romania coming in? Doubts that they'd raised their legal standards to the level that met the requirements of the treaty. It may be investment in transport infrastructure, ports and so on, that if you're in a value chain that includes some of the biggest producers in the world, they want to know that they can get their shipments in and out on a specific time. I mean, for example, I'm told that Turkish producers of gearboxes can now guarantee to get their gearboxes from Turkey to the Volkswagen factory in Wolfsburg plus or minus 2 hours. Well, that's a pretty extraordinary achievement, if so. And you can see that that sort of improvement in logistics can spill over to other people. The question I have to say, well, yes, I mean, it's all very well asking this question, how does, here are some I'm giving some plausible answers, but how does it work? And this, I think, is the challenge for that we are trying to face up to at the moment. If you're looking at regulation, which particular bit of the regulation is it that spurs or slows the benefits of that regulation getting through to improving productivity or quality of goods or quality of services? How would changing the regulation affect the behavior of firms and consumers? What's the impact of the change on productivity and the potential for growth, and hence on economic development? And I think this is the key point. If we're simply just making sure the existing resources are a bit better used, that's good, but it's not substantial. If you're starting to get improvements in productivity and growth, then you're releasing resources that can add to the development prospects. So what's the research agenda here? These are the questions that interest me in this context, and not the whole agenda, and others of my colleagues would have other things to add to this. We are in the process of thinking our way through this at the moment. The final objective is sometime next year to make an application to the SRC for a very substantial amount of money to set up essentially a research center on these issues. We think we are ahead of most of the competition on this, but we want to make sure that we are properly prepared when we come to make the application. So the things that interest me are the impact of trade on firm level productivity. And on this, there's an existing literature on this, and we need to make some theoretical advances, and we need to then start thinking about how that can be modeled. We have to look at the potential impact of regulatory integration. I've mentioned this already, but just to complete the story, on costs, on innovation and competition, the key question may be, how does changing regulation affect competition? Does it increase it or reduce it? Economists, as you know, are highly persuaded that more competition is better for society all round. How do we find this out? Maybe we have to end up asking producers and consumers. There's already a center on risk and regulation at the LSE, and their sort of regular report came around, and there in the middle of this was assessing costs and benefits of regulation. And I thought, oh, my God, they've got there. They're there ahead of us. Well, I opened it up, and basically what they've got is someone from the National Consumer Council and someone from the Institute of Directors saying, you know, more regulation is good or bad, depending on which side they were on of the particular debate. So I breathed a sigh of relief at that point and thought we still maybe have got a job in front of us. So I think we need to look at cases, and we need to probably look to survey data to drill down into what's going on when these particular things change. I think the other question which comes out of Sherman's maps is whether regionalism is institutionally more conducive to deep integration. The WTO, which works at a global level with 150 members, clearly finds it difficult to engage with deep integration. The services part of the WTO is, if not more abundant, certainly very slow acting. The one bit of it that does seem to be efficient on intellectual property, any of you who have been reading the newspapers will know, has been deeply, deeply controversial over the last 10 years. There are other parts of it on things such as sanitary and phytosanitary standards and so on, which have also been deeply controversial. So is there something in regionalism which does this? And you look at the EU and the way in which, I mean, the heart of the political debate on Europe in this country is how much more institution building do we need and to what purpose? And the question one always asks is, could we have done as much? Could we have gone to the ultimate deep integration, you might argue, which is economic and monetary union? I know the UK is not a member, so the we is a rather general we in this context. But clearly, could we have done that without the institutional superstructure that was there, with a parliament and a court and a commission and a council? Or is it simply that these regional clusters we see simply owe this to geography? It's simply a matter of not being very distant from each other and being in economic gravity in the sense of being at perhaps in this case, at roughly equal levels of development, and therefore the sort of integration we see across East Asia comes out of that. These are the sorts of puzzles that I think we're left with, which, at least from my perspective, I think we need to try and deal with. Probably in 6 to 8 or 9 months' time, we'll know whether we've got the beginnings of an approach to this. But as Michael said at the beginning, 8 years is a long time before you give a professorial lecture. Though I would add, I gave a series of 3 lectures on EMU in 1999, but maybe they weren't called a professorial lecture in those terms when I arrived. But so I thought I would give you something that was forward-looking rather than backward-looking in this context. And I apologize to my colleagues if I've taken them for granted or I've misrepresented them in what I think is essentially a team activity rather than one that simply reflects me. Okay, I'll stop there. And I'm happy to take any questions anyone wants to put to me.